Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Later in the show, we'll be talking about the government's role in housing finance, whether it should be changed or abolished altogether. But first, in other economic news, after learning this week that new applications for unemployment benefits unexpectedly rose, a report out today shows that those who are employed aren't doing so well either. Fidelity Investments, the world's largest administrator of retirement savings plans like 401ks, says a record number of workers made what's known as hardship withdrawals from their 401ks during the second quarter. A decade high of 62,000 workers made these withdrawals. That's up 32% from the same time last year. Joining us from Washington is USA Today's personal finance reporter, Sandra Block. And Sandra, first, tell us about these hardship withdrawals. What are they, and how does someone go about getting one?
Well, for a 401k hardship withdrawal, it's actually not easy to get. You have to go to your employer and request it, and you have to cite very specific reasons because there are IRS guidelines governing what constitutes a hardship withdrawal. You can't just go in and say, I'm having trouble buying groceries. You have to show, for example, that you're facing foreclosure, that you have serious medical problems, that you have tuition bills that you have to pay. So there's some pretty specific guidelines the IRS has, and employers can be even more restrictive.
And you're penalized, and there are tax consequences from these withdrawals as well.
Yes, the consequences are really quite severe. You'll have to pay income taxes on the entire amount that you withdraw, which could be anywhere from 25% to 28%, depending on your tax bracket. And if you're under 59.5, you'll pay on top of that a 10% penalty for withdrawing early withdrawal. There are a few exceptions for that penalty, but they're not many. So you could assume that you're going to give up to a third of the amount that you take out in taxes.
So anyone who does this must really need the money. Why do you think this increased 32% higher than the same time last year?
Well, it's really troubling because, as I said, you give up so much. I worry that some people may not understand the consequences of doing this, but I also think it just speaks to how hard up people are. Even if people are still working, they may have had their salaries reduced, many people have been furloughed, and it's possible that someone else in their household has lost a job. The other possibility is they've lost so much equity in their homes that they are underwater and perhaps are having trouble paying the mortgage and are facing foreclosure. So I think that it speaks to some of the hardships that people are suffering that they would do this. It's much easier to take money if you have an individual retirement account on your own. You don't have to offer a reason to take money out of that. You can do that anytime you want. So what that says to me is that people have already probably drained those, and now they're turning to 401k plans. And these are people who have jobs. So it kind of speaks to the economic difficulties that people who are employed are having.
You know, the report by Fidelity also says that the top reasons people report for taking these withdrawals are to, as you say, prevent foreclosure, eviction, pay for college, or buying a home. But the report says that the applications for a loan from your 401k also rose, and that's a little bit different. How do those loans work?
Well, this is one thing that bothers me. I'm troubled that more people aren't taking out a loan instead of a hardship withdrawal. When you take out a 401k loan, you can take out a loan that has to be repaid over up to 5 years. You can take out at least $50,000, if not more, $50,000 or 50% of the amount in your account. You pay interest, but right now the interest rate on 401k loans is very low. It's around 5% in many cases. And when you repay the loan, you're paying yourself back. You're not paying a lender. The payments are deducted from your paycheck every month. So while there are certainly disadvantages to a loan, it's not nearly as hard on your account as a hardship withdrawal because there is always the possibility that you'll pay it all back. Now, the one big downside to loans is this. If you leave your job or you quit or you're fired or whatever, then you have to pay it back, usually within 90 days, or it's treated like a withdrawal. So what may have happened in some of these cases is that people started out with a loan and then they left their jobs and it turned into a withdrawal.
And according to the report, the average age of those taking these hardship withdrawals was between 35 and 55. And those are the peak earning years. Why during this time? And is it a wise financial move?
It's never a wise financial move to take a hardship withdrawal. It can be a wise financial move to take a loan if you have no other source of income and you're confident that you'll stay on the job long enough to pay it back. But you're right. This is the time of life when people should be stashing lots of money away in retirement. And we already know that people aren't saving enough, and this is simply eroding the amount that they're saving even more. But I think perhaps what we're seeing is people in this age group are more likely to own a home, and so these folks would be more likely to be facing problems associated with foreclosures.
This report was issued by Fidelity Investments, and it also indicates that a good chunk of workers who made hardship withdrawals this year did it last year as well. How unusual is that, that people do it twice? And can we assume this is a pattern across the industry?
Well, Fidelity is large enough, yes, that their results are indicative of probably what's going on elsewhere. It certainly isn't unique to Fidelity. I'm not aware of people going back and taking multiple hardship withdrawals. I really do think that speaks to the severity of this downturn.
Sandra, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sandra Block is the personal finance reporter for USA Today. Scientists from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute here in Massachusetts have discovered a 22-mile-long plume of oil more than 3,000 feet beneath the surface in the Gulf of Mexico, left over from BP's deepwater well. That raises questions over how much oil is left in the Gulf, since the government and BP had claimed earlier this month that 75% of the oil from BP's oil gusher had dispersed. Meanwhile, with oil lurking beneath the surface, what does that mean for the safety of seafood? Earlier this week, President Barack Obama gave his strong endorsement for Gulf seafood while visiting the Florida Panhandle.
We already had some seafood in the White House when the New Orleans Saints came up. We had a couple of po' boys. So right now we're feeling pretty good.
But a team of scientists from the Florida Institute of Oceanography in St. Petersburg just wrapped up a 10-day expedition in the Gulf of Mexico where they found signs of oil in microscopic plankton, the very base of the food chain. We're going to ask the chief seafood scientist from NOAA what that might mean for food safety in a minute. But first, we turn to John Paul. He's a marine microbiologist who was on the University of South Florida expedition. And John, first of all, what does it look like out on the Gulf now in terms of oil?
Clearly, if you're out on the Gulf, it looks fine from shipboard, from satellite, from airplanes. Most of the slicks are gone, but if you use other techniques, chemical, biochemical, and biosensors, you get another story, and it may be dispersed into very small micro droplets, which can only be detected by analytical techniques.
So when you take a closer look, it might be a different story. What does that mean? Where did you find oil, and what does that indicate to you?
The thing that was a bit surprising was that we had found oil in the subsurface about 40 miles off of Panama City in 25 and 50 meters depth of water. So we found oil coming up the DeSoto Canyon, which is a natural feature that connects the deep offshore with the nearshore environment, and that had not been shown before. And we also found evidence of oil on the surface and the subsurface farther west between Panama City and the Deepwater Horizon well site. And the other thing that was surprising that Dr. Hollander found, my colleague, there was indications of oil droplets in the sediment up towards the Panama City area. So there's oil in the subsurface, there's some oil in the surface, and there's some oil in the sediments. The exact concentrations we have yet to determine. What I found was about 30% of the samples were toxic either to phytoplankton or bacteria plankton.
So if plankton that makes up the base of the marine food chain is contaminated with oil, could that affect the entire ecosystem of the Gulf?
Yes, it could, but the bad news is that we found oil in 30% of the samples. The good news is we didn't find it in the other 70%. So I think it's going to take a length of time to determine what the final impact has been on the marine ecosystems and the fisheries, because fish larvae are very sensitive to hydrocarbons, and those larvae impacted now may not mature for 3 to 5 years, depending upon the species, and there may be blips in the fish catch further on in the future.
But many other people, including President Obama, say Gulf seafood is safe to eat. They've already made proclamations about how it's okay. It's been looked at, and go ahead and enjoy your po' boy sandwich. Is that irresponsible? Is it too early to tell?
I don't think it's irresponsible. I mean, I was just in Panama City after the cruise, and I tried to get an oyster po' boy, and they weren't selling any oyster po' boys at the restaurants because they were concerned about contamination. So certainly the seafood industry monitors the quality. They would not sell tainted shellfish, so I think that the safeguards are there. Now, the thing that we don't know is how persistent this oil is or the toxicity. It may be that in a couple weeks' time, everything will be down to undetectable levels of toxicity in oil, or it might be a couple months, or it might be a couple years, or it could even be a couple decades. There's no precedent for an oil spill of this magnitude, so we really are learning as we go along.
You also looked at dispersants on this expedition, and the FDA has said that the dispersants used to break up the oil, while it was still gushing into the Gulf, are not harmful to seafood because they break up in the water. But they are doing more tests to look at the long-term effects. Do you have concerns about dispersants?
I was contacted from somebody from the Gulf Coast Research Lab in Mississippi, and they found what looked like oil in crabs. And when they got it analyzed, they found out it was dispersant. So some concern about what might be happening to at least crustaceans in this environment. I don't think they really know what the long-term fate is. And then the other question is that oil, as we know, floats on top of water. Once you mix it with dispersants, there's a good chance that it sinks. And when it gets down into the cold water of the subsurface ocean, the rate of breakdown can be very, very slow. So there's a tendency for the persistence of the oil that might be brought on by the dispersant, because, quite frankly, these have not been used in deep water spills. They've been used principally in coastal zones, and they seem to be effective, but they may be more problematic in the deep ocean.
So you're saying it might not be as effective in the deep water of the ocean as it's been used in other areas?
Yes, it looks like what it's doing is resulting in the transport into the deeper waters and the deep sediments where the breakdown may be much slower. And if that water gets into the coastal zone, we'll be seeing it again. So I don't think we have a really good way of getting rid of oil. We can get it out of sight. We can get it out of the surface waters, but then it may accumulate in the deep waters and persist for some time.
So a lot of unknowns still about this oil spill and the effects of it. John Paul is a marine microbiologist at the University of South Florida. He recently went on a 10-day expedition in the Gulf of Mexico. Thanks for joining us, John.
Okay, thank you.
So if the oil is lurking deep beneath the ocean, how can the government determine whether or not sea life is being affected by the oil, and what safeguards are in place? Up next, we'll talk to the chief government scientist in charge of making sure that our seafood is safe. He'll explain the so-called sniff tests and talk about other steps scientists are taking to test seafood. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking today about the long-term impacts of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. And as we've just heard before the break, scientists have found oil deep beneath the ocean, where colder temperatures will make it take longer for the oil to break up and disperse. And scientists found oil in microscopic plankton, which is at the base of the ocean food chain. Meanwhile, Louisiana waters reopened to shrimpers this week. So how safe is the seafood? John Stein is head of the Seafood Safety Program in the Gulf. He joins us on the line from Seattle, where he's based. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And John, first, can you say without a doubt that the seafood coming out of the Gulf of Mexico is safe to eat?
Yes, I can. We have a comprehensive program in place that's been developed between NOAA, FDA, EPA, and the states. And it consists of the key component is the ability to close fishing areas to fishing if necessary. And NOAA has that capability. And so that was the first step that was taken. And the first closure occurred on May 2nd. And if needed, those closures were adjusted daily based on the trajectory of the oil. So fish caught legally in the Gulf since the spill are safe for human consumption.
How can you be so sure, though? When we just heard from a microbiologist saying he's finding oil in plankton, the very base of the food chain.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, there is certainly oil out there, and those recent studies on plankton are in the deeper parts of the ocean, as I understand, and because that's where we're finding that dispersed oil is in the deeper parts of the ocean. And most of the commercially and recreationally important fish species are caught on the shelf in shallower waters. So that's one component. The other component is just that we have this comprehensive program, and we will not reopen any area until the oil is gone. There's no chance it'll return. And then the seafood must pass a sensory test to oil and dispersant, and then it also must pass a analytical chemistry test.
Let's talk about that sensory test or sniff test. Tell us how that works.
How it works is that the human nose is very sensitive. So the sensory panelists are trained to be able to detect oil. They were then trained also, even though we don't think this is likely, but just to be sure, to train to be able to detect dispersant alone, because as we know, the dispersant was only used in the presence of oil.
Do these sniffers have better noses than the rest of us?
Yes, because they've been trained. They've been evaluated to show that they can be able to detect differences from normal. That's what really they're trying to do. Is the fish or the shellfish different from what a good, healthy piece of seafood is? And so they can be able to detect rancidity. They can detect oil. They could detect dispersant. So it's the training that makes them more sensitive, but actually it can be too sensitive. So you want to be able to have that discriminatory ability.
What about the fish that comes in off a fisherman's boat catch and is just sold nearby or goes into the food distribution chain? How do you catch that?
Well, we are doing some what is called dockside monitoring, again, to add another layer of confidence. So people from both FDA and parts of NOAA are sampling a catch that comes in off fishing vessels in fishing ports, and then that, too, also goes through the sensory and chemical testing.
And if it's found to be contaminated, what happens?
Just want to emphasize that hasn't happened, but if by the slightest chance that some tainted seafood did get through, we would certainly need to look at where that seafood came from and go back and close an area if needed. But I'm because of the extensive nature of our testing, well over and above what is normally done because of the scale of this incident, we're confident that that's really at a low probability to happen.
Will we be seeing fish recalls?
Oh, I don't think so, no.
What about dispersants? The FDA says dispersants aren't harmful to humans. Why aren't they?
Key reason is that they're water soluble. That's their property, but they have also a property to be able to interact with the oil and then disperse it. So because of that solubility in water, there's not a high potential for it to accumulate in tissues, and if it doesn't accumulate in tissues, it can't reach very high concentrations.
But we understand that NOAA and the EPA are doing tests on dispersants and their toxicity and the ability to concentrate in fish tissue. Why are those studies needed if you say the FDA says that dispersants aren't harmful?
Just out of an abundance of caution, people have questions, so we're carrying out the studies to add additional data to corroborate that in this particular instance where it was used in this situation, in this ecosystem, under these conditions, we confirm the previous findings.
Let's go back to the plankton for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
There's oil found in the plankton. The plankton is at the base of the marine food chain. So if fish eat that plankton, does it then contaminate the fish? And what does this mean down the road in the next months and years?
So the plankton would accumulate some pHs. That is very true.
And pHs are oil.
pHs are some of the toxic compounds in oil that are of concern from a human health perspective. And yes, fish could consume those plankton. And the ability of fish to metabolize pHs is very high. And during that metabolism, it changes the shape, if you will, and the nature of the compounds. And they are then more easily excreted, very easily excreted, from the body. So they don't accumulate to high levels. And therefore, since they don't accumulate at high levels, they also don't accumulate in the muscle tissue that we like to eat. That metabolism also could lead to effects within the organism itself, and especially of concern is the early life stages of fish.
Talking about those early life stages, isn't there a concern about fish larvae, which are sensitive to oil? If oil affects fish during the reproductive cycle, could that somehow make it unsafe to humans down the line? And how would you determine that?
No, it won't make it unsafe to humans down the line, again, because of this metabolism process. It doesn't accumulate, unlike things like mercury, which accumulate over time. But there certainly is a large effort within NOAA to look at effects on early life history and what are potential consequences down the road.
Have you eaten Gulf seafood, and what would you recommend?
I certainly have, and I like all of it. Certainly, grouper is at high in my list, and there's a local restaurant in Pascagoula that makes shrimp and grits that are pretty good.
That's a Mississippi restaurant, right?
It's a Mississippi restaurant, yes.
John Stein is head of the Seafood Safety Program in the Gulf. Thanks for joining us, John.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Monday on Here and Now, tacky tourist photos. We have a slideshow already posted at our website, hereandnow.org, and we want to see your tacky photos. You can post them on our Facebook site. Just search Facebook for WBUR's Here and Now. Back after the news, Here and Now. Some people might think Twitter efficiency is an oxymoron, since the social media service can be such a time drain. But this week, a new application called Twefficiency practically took over Twitter. The application claims to measure someone's Twitter efficiency based on their Twitter activity. Some people got upset because their Twefficiency scores got automatically tweeted out to all of their followers. It became one of the most popular topics on Twitter. Some people thought it was spam or a scam, but it turns out the app was developed by 17-year-old James Cunningham of Dundee, Scotland, and he joins us. Hi, James.
Hello.
What do you think of the reaction you got to your application?
I was really surprised by the reaction. I wasn't expecting it, and I didn't think there would be much of an issue with the tweet functionality.
You mean tweeting it out to other people to give that Twefficiency score to all the people following you?
Yeah, I didn't realize that would be such a problem because the people I'd showed it to before hadn't complained about it, and some had even said it was a good idea.
Well, people started bragging about their scores as well. We here at Here and Now got a 43%, and our friends over at the public radio program The World tweeted they got 46%. But tell us, what are you actually measuring?
It's measuring the, first off, it'll look at how many people you're following and how many people following you. This other thing it'll look at is how many messages you get sent and how many of them you actually reply to, which is why many celebrities get really low scores, because generally they have a lot of followers and are following very few people, and they get sent a lot of messages and don't reply to very many.
So somebody like Demi Moore and Ashton Kutcher, who I know are huge tweeters, might get a low score even though they have probably thousands, maybe millions of followers?
Yeah, they would get pretty low scores. And actually, Stephen Fry, he's very big in the UK. He writes a lot of books and does a lot of TV presence. And I was really surprised when he tweeted me saying he got a pretty low score. But that's mainly because they're not following as many people who are following them and don't reply to as much.
We've heard there could be some job prospects for you out of this after your application went viral. We hear you've been getting calls. What do you see happening from here?
Firstly, I'd like to take the application a bit forward, add some more functionality, add more features that people could use, and some more clarification of what the score actually means. And that's what I'd like to see forward. And as for the job offers, I haven't had any hard offers yet, but I've seen some tweets.
Okay, thank you very much, James.
Thank you.
James Cunningham is a 17-year-old amateur computer programmer from Dundee, Scotland. His Twitter application, Twefficiency, went viral on the social media service this week. And you can follow us on Twitter at Here and Now. We will claim great Twefficiency, even though we still have no idea what that means. Well, we don't want to end the week without a nod to a baseball legend.
Back of throws. There's a long pass. It's going to be, I believe. The Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant.
Bobby Thompson, who won the pennant and hit arguably the most famous home run in baseball history, the so-called shot heard round the world for the New York Giants against the Brooklyn Dodgers' Ralph Branca, died Monday at his home in Savannah, Georgia. He was 86. The ball Thompson hit out of the Polo Grounds on October 3, 1951, to cap baseball's most memorable pennant drive was never recovered, though the search for it became baseball's holy grail. Last year, Here and Now's Robin Young asked Thompson about that missing ball.
You know, from the moment you hit it, people claimed that they had the ball. Tell us that story. You went into the locker room at one point, and there were how many balls sitting there?
Well, as I entered the Yankee Stadium the following day, a guy met me and had a ball in his hand. He said, "Bobby, this is the ball you hit yesterday. I'd be glad to give it to you if you get me 2 tickets to today's game," without even thinking. I said, "Whoa, stay right there." And Eddie Logan, a locker room guy, laughed at me. And I thought, "Well, what are you laughing at? He's standing out there with the ball." And he took me over to the chair in front of my locker, and there were about 8 so-called home run balls sitting on my chair. So that was the end of that.
Well, not quite. Over the years, Thompson appeared with Ralph Branca at old-timers games and autograph shows. Thompson once remarked that Ralph didn't run away and hide, and Branca responded, "I lost a game, but I made a friend." We bet a lot of people said that about Bobby Thompson. We'll be back in just a bit. It's Here and Now. More bad news on the housing front today. A new report says nearly half of the homeowners seeking help from the Obama administration's flagship effort to prevent foreclosures have fallen out of the program. The Treasury Department study out today also suggests foreclosures could rise in the second half of the year and weaken the already ailing housing market. The report comes as the Obama administration considers reforms to the role the government plays in homeownership. This week, dozens of experts were invited to the Treasury Department to discuss that issue. At the center of the debate are the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which the government took over more than 2 years ago. Benjamin Applebaum of the New York Times sat in on this week's conference, and he joins us from the Christian Science Monitor studios in Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
First, your reaction to this new report from the Treasury Department.
This is not a surprise. We've known for some time that the primary effect of this Obama administration program, but also almost everything that has been done by the government with respect to foreclosures, is really to delay foreclosures rather than to prevent them. It doesn't address the fundamental problem that a lot of homeowners are living in homes that are worth far less than the amount they owe on them. It doesn't address the number of unemployed people who simply can't make mortgage payments at all. We've been pushing the problem forward. This is one means of pushing it forward, but nothing that the government has done so far really amounts to a concerted effort to prevent foreclosures.
And remind us now of what the government role is in housing finance. How extensive is it?
It's huge. The United States government subsidizes homeownership in almost more ways than you can count on the fingers of two hands. But the centerpiece of it for the last several decades has been two companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which essentially provide the money for mortgage loans by buying loans that banks and other lenders make and then selling those loans to investors to recharge their own coffers, buying more loans, selling them. This pumps money into the American mortgage market. It helps to hold down mortgage interest rates. It is the way that we make mortgage loans available to the vast majority of American families at a relatively low price.
So how much reform of the current system is really needed? What's the case for reform?
Well, the system collapsed, as I think we all remember. The housing market popped a couple years ago. Housing prices went tumbling. We are living with the consequences, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were left holding millions of loans that were no longer being repaid. Those companies quickly ran out their own reserves. At that point, the government stepped in and said, "We'll make good on their losses." So far, that's cost taxpayers about $150 billion, a price tag that's going to keep on climbing. And so what we're left with is a system that has suddenly become exorbitantly expensive and remarkably ineffective. And the question is, what do we want to put in its place?
And this is a politically charged issue as well. Republicans criticized the decision not to address Fannie and Freddie in the legislation overhauling financial regulation that the president signed into law last month. And the Democrats argued that that was impossible to include because it was just too much of a Pandora's box to open. You were at the conference. Did politics enter the discussion?
You know, they were pretty careful this week to keep politics to the side. But it's a politically charged discussion on two levels. The first is just generally that in Washington right now, Democrats are in charge, and so they're being held responsible for getting things done, and Republicans have a political opportunity to critique them when things go slowly or are not getting done. The broader issue is the question about homeownership and to what extent the federal government should subsidize homeownership, and it's a basic ideological dispute between Democrats, who tend to see the government as a positive force in society and believe that it can help lower-income families achieve homeownership and build wealth, and Republicans, who are inherently suspicious about the effectiveness of government and tend to believe that the government's going to make a mess of things and that it should stay on the sidelines and allow the private market to provide mortgage loans.
Well, what's the way out of the situation? What options does the government have?
There are basically three options available to the government. There are the two extremes. On the one hand, removing the government from the mortgage market and allowing people to get loans from banks if they can. That would likely make mortgage loans much more expensive and less available. On the other extreme, the government could continue in its present role, in which it basically provides all of the available mortgage loans and is essentially the marketplace for mortgage loans. That makes mortgage loans very cheap. We've seen mortgage rates plummet to record lows and stay there for, you know, more than a year now, and that's made homeownership very accessible to people who have jobs at the very least. And then there's the midpoint, and that's probably where the government is going, and that is to create some new version of the old system in which the government supports the private market. And it basically does that by providing some form of guarantee that if things go horribly wrong, the government will step in, as it has done in recent years.
Is the Obama administration flagging what it wants to do?
The direction of their consideration is focused on building a new system to buttress the private market. The details of that are still months away. The goal is to have a proposal that can be unveiled in January, and even that would be an outline that would then launch a legislative process to fill in the details. But what they're trying to build is a better version of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They're not going to call it that because those brands are horribly tarnished and no one likes those companies anymore. But what you're going to see is some new version of a government program that subsidizes mortgage lending and that subsidizes home ownership.
Could the housing market ever stand on its own without the government playing a role at all?
Well, this is pretty controversial. You heard at the conference this week, Bill Gross, one of the nation's largest investors in mortgage loans, the co-founder of an investment firm called PIMCO, said point blank that was never going to happen again, that private investors, himself included, simply wouldn't buy mortgage loans that weren't government guaranteed. He said, you know, the only circumstances under which he'd do such a thing is if people were making down payments of 30%, and even then they'd have to pay much higher interest rates. And you know, he has the authority of being a person who actually buys mortgage loans. A lot of people are very skeptical about that and believe that a private market will return for at least some loan products. But it has been the case for a long time that the mortgage lending market is fundamentally federally subsidized. We don't really have any idea of what it would look like if the government left. And frankly, there's not a lot of political appetite for finding out.
Well, there's a lot more to come on that. We'll be following it at Here and Now. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Benjamin Applebaum covers economic issues for the New York Times. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any other story. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email. We read every single one, or you can leave a comment there on the home phone. Our call, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now. Though listeners might not be familiar with singer-songwriter Matis Yahoo's name, they might recognize his sound. NBC used his song One Day to promote the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver. That's One Day off Matis Yahoo's latest CD, Light. Matis Yahoo was born Matthew Miller in the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn. He began his musical career by singing songs of religious devotion set to reggae rhythms and had an unlikely hit in 2005 with the song King Without a Crown from his CD Live at Stubbs. This week, Matis Yahoo recorded a second Live at Stubbs album as part of his summer tour, which you can find out about at hereandnow.org. But in the meantime, we thought we'd reprise a conversation Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa had with Matis Yahoo at a pre-concert soundcheck last summer. She spoke to him about his circuitous journey to pop music, which included a detour to follow the band Phish and an experiment with drugs, something he gave up after he became deeply immersed in Judaism, which he first discovered in his teens.
I went to Israel when I was 16 years old. And I, around that time, started to deal with some of the questions of identity and spirituality. When I went to Israel, I felt a connection to my Jewish heritage for the first time.
You did go sort of through a phase that a lot of teens go through. You did do some experimenting with drugs. You also were into rock music.
Yes. I'd had sort of this powerful experience in Israel. I was looking for a way to duplicate that experience or to find that. And I went with one of the kids from Israel to a Phish concert, and we dropped LSD for the first time. And that was an extremely life-changing experience. And I began to look for my spirituality through music and drugs. There was another phase where I went out to Oregon, and I spent a lot of time in the wilderness and experiencing God through nature. And then I sort of came back to New York, went to college, became into the Judaism, changed my style of clothing, changed the food that I ate, the rules that I followed, tried to become another person. One of the only things that I kind of held on to from my previous life was the music. I put my band together and I started doing little performances inside the community. One of the things that Chabad is known for is sort of rabbi set up shop in areas that are typically not necessarily religious or big Jewish areas.
I'm sorry, Chabad?
Chabad is the Hasidic, one of the Hasidic groups. And so when they were looking for somebody who could relate to the non-religious crowd of Jews that would be coming to their synagogue, but that could have some kind of, you know, message about God or Judaism in their lyrics as well, I kind of fit the bill.
The song that really broke you was the song King Without a Crown. It became a huge success. What was that like for you? I mean, was it a shock or...?
It wasn't really shocking. I mean, at that time it was, you know, I was coming out of this very surreal reality where I had, you know, been this one person and I had shed myself and moved into this other world all based on faith. So I was living in a very kind of dreamy, and I had always sort of been that way from the days, from the drugs, you know, from all that stuff. So even though I was more grounded in, you know, in this Orthodox religion, you know, the ideas behind it and the belief, you know, just this was this faith in God, and that sort of if you give yourself and your life over to God, then, you know, anything is possible. So when the song started taking off, it was kind of like, oh, of course it is, you know what I mean? I did everything I was supposed to do, you know, I gave myself to God, and so of course God is taking care of me right now.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the new album. You have been very closely identified with reggae, but on the CD it feels like you're expanding and looking at other kinds of music. There's one song, I think it's called For You, that to me, the sort of the chorus had almost a U2 anthem-like feel, or it just had a whole different feel to it.
Well, I think with my first record that I made, and the second one also, you know, the music that I had been influenced by mainly as a vocalist was reggae music. And in reggae music, the voice, the vocal, is able to somehow take a place within the music as though it's almost one of the instruments, you know. And when I became religious, I really stopped listening to music for a while, for a couple of years. And when I started listening again, it wasn't necessarily to reggae music, you know. And the last few years for me, I've been listening to all kinds of different stuff, from the staple indie rock stuff like Arcade Fire, Flaming Lips, heavy synthesizer kind of dance stuff, to bands like U2 or The Clash, all kinds of different stuff. And that's all sort of started to influence me and to create this new sound. No words to hold, hopes, questions or solutions. Bedrock of a river that flows. We are men of nature, we are made from the earth. At the end of my 80, I'll return to the dirt. Just sand. Are you still Orthodox? I would still consider myself Orthodox. I mean, I eat kosher, and I eat a very high level of kosher because that's just what I've been doing. And I keep Shabbos, you know, I pray three times a day.
How do you sort of maintain that self and still maintain the performer? I know that in general you don't perform on Friday nights.
Right.
You do perform in front of mixed audiences, you know, male and female. But do you keep those identities sort of apart or together? Or is that not a question that your religious self is yourself?
I try to keep it as one whole being, you know what I mean? And the music, and when I go out on stage and I do my music, it can be a spiritual thing for me, and for, you know, that's what music has always been for me. So the rules, you know, I really find that the rules have been helpful for me in a lot of ways in terms of discipline and having a spiritual discipline, and, you know, waking up in the morning and knowing, just like, I gotta warm up my voice, you know, I gotta warm up my God consciousness. This whole period of my life and this record has been about re-evaluating who I am and where I am, and sort of coming to terms with the idea that you may never find that truth, you know, that it's a constant search. And that's been sort of a tough process for me to go through, but it's been really freeing. Where am I? Who
am I? That's musician Matis Yahu speaking with Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa. I will be Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now. Time will continue without you, so in the end, it's not about you, but what did you do? Who